Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Roy Freed, global pioneer of computer law on computers, the mind, information, and their serious implications. Roy, you just have a remarkable background. I mean, looking at your just tremendous history of success and contribution over so many decades. So we really appreciate you coming in today to do this interview, and thank you for sharing your work and experiences with our audience.
It's certainly my pleasure. I'm honored by the fact that you have chosen me, and I'm thrilled with this opportunity to try to share my ideas with others in the hope of helping them understand who they are and how they fit into society and cause society to work. So thank you very much.
Roy, looking at your background, really, you've done so much that it'd fill law libraries, I think. You've made so many contributions. So in this next question, I'm going to sort of get you to sort of scrunch that down a bit. And if you can describe yourself, and I know this is going to be hard, in about 5 seconds, I should say 5 sentences or less.
Well, it's a pleasure to try that. It's an ego boost with this opportunity. But I try to be an open-minded, objective person. I try to be a helping person, and combined those two aspects, I have the wonderful opportunity to think deeply about the human mind. I try to be as objective as possible, subject to the normal subjectivity of people, and my experience at helping people has earned me the wonderful relationships by people substantially all over the world. And that probably is the best I can describe for myself. I'm fortunate, it appears, to have a better functioning mind now at 94 than I ever had before. And I have the luxury in retirement to exercise my mind as fully as possible.
Well, you know, that's interesting. I saw some research recently indicating that as people go post 45, sometimes their ability to judge gets better because the two hemispheres get better integrated. Maybe it's that corpus callosum, that sort of that channel that communicates between the two. Perhaps that gets better with age.
Well, in my case, I'm very fortunate that this continues, and I'm doing the best I can to use it constructively.
Now, if you can share some currently usable life and career lessons with the audience, that would be appreciated, especially because of your long history of success and impactful roles on the world.
Well, I must admit first that I've made my share of mistakes and have my share of problems, but I probably am fortunate that I early on recognized the importance of being adaptable to change. That's characteristic of the modern society. In my case, it's been specifically helpful and enabled me to overcome problems and come out much better than before. That was, as I will describe later, I was very unhappy as a litigator in large antitrust cases, and by my hearing about the newly introduced computers, I was able to parlay that insight to a new career that I am trying to find expressly, but turned up fortuitously. And I guess that is the primary lesson that I learned, and a lesson that I think everyone should learn themselves in order to cope with modern society and developed nations.
You've definitely exhibited agility in terms of doing environmental scans and then reacting to, and then following that, making really substantive contributions to the world.
Well, I'm so thrilled that you say that, because I've hoped I'm a positively oriented, essentially missionary, trying to do my best to contribute, and I'm thrilled that you recognize it so clearly. It's what I guess each person's ego would like.
Now, Roy, what are your current roles, and how will you achieve your goals for each of these roles?
Well, my present goal is to publicize my deep interest in the human mind. In my long retirement, freed from professional responsibilities, I suddenly was inspired to think deeply about my mind and independently. I wanted to be independent because I wanted to reveal my creativity and avoid merely reflecting what other people have contributed. Fortunately, in my case, with my perception of the human mind as a unique, animate, autonomous machine, I haven't found any others trying to contribute ideas in that area of knowledge. I'm astonished by that, but also I'm thrilled to have the unique role I'm playing there. So that's what I'm spending most of my time with, and it's a wonderful activity. It's enjoyable to engage in that thinking and to believe that I'm making an advance of knowledge and contributing to society. So that's what I'm doing in my very long retirement, which I've been going on since 1986.
I guess this kind of reminds me of Bloom's taxonomy, you know, where they talk about knowledge, comprehension, application, analysis, synthesis, and evaluation. And the highest levels of cognitive functioning are really in the application, synthesis, and evaluation. But with your tremendous history of success and background, you're continually going to be operating at that application, synthesis, and evaluation level, which I can see can, you know, where you can make really substantive contributions as a result.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do, and I am basking in reflected glory with that, which is a wonderful, wonderful state of mind.
Well, that's very interesting, and you know, you talked about the mind and how your direction is focusing on that, and especially in a new innovative thinking. So let's delve into some questions in that area.
Oh, certainly.
So why is it unreasonable to attribute behavior to a supernatural force?
Well, it is unreasonable because there is no supernatural force. Belief in God arose from people who were curious about the operation of the human mind, but completely lacked a knowledge about nature and the way it functions. And I think that it also is unreasonable because it diverts people from recognizing that they are responsible for their behavior and are entitled to claim credit for their good behavior. It's unreasonable to think that an undoubtedly non-existent force contributes those aspects of life.
Why is teaching both the universal mind and computers an ideal way to inspire people to think deeply and then want to learn about STEM?
Well, I think that the existence of computers reveals the fundamental workings of the mind, of course, the far superior mind. And I think the prevalence of knowledge about computers, which fascinates people, starting with very young people, is an ideal subject because it is so related to the mind. You build in that approach on obvious understanding and relate features of the computers to the mind to find their superiority and to understand better their relevance to life. And that's particularly true, as you said, to so-called STEM, which is the teaching of science, technology, and mathematics, because computers are so integrated into that area of knowledge and practice.
Do you have a view then, Roy, on the global mind or collective minds working in unison?
I certainly do. I think the fascinating insight is the fact that minds acting collectively or integration, although haphazardly, actually represent the operation of not only societies, but compositely, the entire world. The entire world is essentially, in my estimation, a gigantic, haphazardly operating computational mechanism. And I think that comprehension is an ideal way to understand the environment in which all of us are existing.
I don't know. It sort of brings up pictures of the Borg in Star Trek. So.
Yes, and how? And I think that it's interesting to recognize that we're all individually and automatically involved in that process, that our very lives and our individually and in interaction are just that type of wonderful mechanism.
You know, I'm just thinking then, how does social learning or social evolution, there's this idea of the FOXP2 gene, uniquely lead to the human mind?
Well, evolution created the mind, and And this, you say social evolution. In fact, it is just normal interaction of people as they develop, add new knowledge and understanding. They are the mind, and our living is the result of their operation automatically. I'm not really knowledgeable about the Fox, the P2 gene, but I understand from scientists that it exists, and that's our makeup.
To what degree, then, is the mind a tabula rasa at birth, and how does this explain the adult mind?
Well, I found it fascinating in thinking about how the mind operates, to recognize that the mind that arrives at birth is partially a blank slate. It has remarkable inherent potential abilities in order to operate the instinct or drive to survive, but it lacks the knowledge to enable it to do so effectively, not only wisely, not always wisely, but exercise this instinct or drive to survive. And evolution provided this interesting mechanism by which that knowledge each mind needs arrives automatically from the environment. The environment, of course, starts with the parents, but it continually expands. And because the mind is continually plastic throughout life, and like a sculpture, but the sculpting occurs automatically by the receipt of input signals from the environment, and that creates a unique point of view, state of mind, or ego for each person, and that state of mind influences automatically each person's behavior, so that it's that interesting stream of input that influences the adult mind and creates positive forces and also negative aspects that we'll discuss.
Well, it's interesting how you discussed that, you know, this tabula rasa or sort of partial blank slate at birth, and how it's continually shaped or sculpted through life. And I know that pruning occurs within the brain itself at different times of life, I guess early on, and then also perhaps in your late teens. And then there's this concept of neurogenesis, where you maybe even get a new brain cells being added to your brain, and of course that's going to influence your mind because the sculpting is occurring, and that could occur throughout life. So it's kind of interesting, all of these kind of concepts that you're talking about.
They're fascinating and so important to understand yourself and others, to understand what you are and what your strengths are and what your weaknesses are, on a chance that you can overcome the latter. And it enables you to understand and be more sympathetic to the behavior of others by knowing how universal brains or minds tend to operate.
Rory, what is the role of epigenetics in your model of the mind and environmental influences pre-birth on the mind? For example, I know that food scarcity while pregnant can influence behaviors throughout the life of the newborn.
Well, I'm not an expert on that. I'm not a scientist, which has its positive and negative influences. But I must say that this matter of epigenetics is not something I'm really qualified to talk about. Of course, the development of the fetus is influenced by a number of factors. For example, mothers indulging in drugs can be terribly destructive, drugs and alcohol. But those are factors, I think, that we have to recognize, that the mind starts developing, as you indicate, in the fetus, and continues most actively upon birth.
I guess this then leads to this next question and this whole idea of biases. So what are your views on biases?
Well, I have very strong views, and I think they're very important. That is, as I said, upon birth, the infant starts to receive input signals constituting information from the parents and the environment, and that automatically tends to create in each mind a singular, independent, unique body of knowledge that constitutes the person's point of view or mindset or ego or persona. And that influences its life thereafter as it grows. What's so interesting is that there's a susceptibility each of us has, each mind has, to ideologies represented by the point of view of the parents especially, but also the environment in which the person is living. And that susceptibility to ideologies is a blinding force in most cases, and creates social problems in this respect. The mind persona uses its instinct or drive to survive to protect not only the physical structure of its body, but also that ego or persona. And it protects it by argumentation and also by violence. And the net result of that is interaction that is to leads to polarization, which we observe so vividly in current society in the United States and many other places. And I think that is the a factor that's so fundamental to understand and to try to overcome its negative aspect, however possible. It's quite a challenge because the ego and mindset are so deeply embedded and protected by each person.
It's interesting that you talk about how, you know, these forces or these biases occur, and you know, people can perhaps get constrained in their thinking, even to the point of not listening to logic or the facts, maybe even driven by emotion. I'm a Canadian, but I sometimes see that in the political system in Canada, but also in your country as well.
And so it's really a fundamental problem. Ideologies are very comfortable for people because they enable them to avoid thinking. There's an economy of mental energy in having an understanding automatically without probing the aspects of what appear to be new inputs to the mind, and it's a very serious problem. I've been thinking deeply on how to counteract the occurrence and influence of ideologies, but all I can dream of is to try to foster objective critical thinking, which is antithetical to ideologies, and that to my mind, that activity is absolutely most fundamental aspect of teaching children especially, but all people.
So then this ties into this next question, Moy, and that is, what are your views on resistance to change?
That seems to be a fundamental aspect of most mind, and it's so harmful. It's destructive, people, so many people tend to resist new ideas, and it's shocking. I've encountered that in connection with my effort to publicize my perception of the mind, and it's amazing how self-destructive it can be for so many people. It's a big challenge to counteract that automatic creation of ideologies.
What are your views then on this concept of I think, therefore I am? I guess it's cogito ergo sum, or versus something like I am, thus I think.
Well, that brings up Descartes, who was a very important early philosopher. And as I think of them, I think they're just two sides of the same coin. People have to think in order to exist. They have to think both for devising their activities and operating their body structure, although there isn't much think there. In that activity, it's not ordinarily positive thinking, but merely the mechanistic operation of the body as a chemical factory system and producer of the electrical energy needed to operate it. And then so when you talk about I am, thus I think, that indicates the fact that people normally are created by evolution to think both overtly and subconsciously in order to operate as a individual functioning animate machine. Descartes deserves a lot of credit for those perceptions, and he was not as helpful when he devised the so-called mind-body problem, which continues to be a silly diversion for philosophers because he couldn't understand the actual physical connection between the mind and the so-called body, which it operates much as a computer operates a system in which it's installed.
You bring this idea of a computer up, Roy. So explain how computers can be modeled for a overall top-down functional explanation of the human mind.
There have been philosophers of mind, at least since Plato and Aristotle, but probably well before that history was recorded. And those philosophers of mind had no way to understand the physical nature and functioning of the mind. And so they speculated in so many cases ridiculously. For example, I heard that some philosophers of mind characterized the contents of the skull as gunk, which is hardly informative. And that persisted until not many decades ago when neuroscientists finally learned and announced that the human mind consists of a vast network of neuronal circuitry or pathways, and through them flowed batches of neurons that represent facts and ideas. And that opened up the opportunity, finally, to find analogies in computers that were informative through their comprising these networks of wires through which batches of electromagnetic pulse signals flow that clearly represent facts and ideas. In fact, words and numbers are purely abstract in the mind, and the mind operates only on these physical batches of energy signals. So the computers provide a model for inferring the presence of these various features in the mind and provide opportunities for comparing them in computers with those of the mind. And I found that it has been a major contribution to my understanding, and I think it's an ideal basis for other people to gain the same understanding.
Do you feel then that there's some kind of a critical mass that occurs where you have enough neural circuitry or where you get sort of the existence of the mind, and perhaps then in even in terms of computers, if you have enough electronic circuitry at some point, you'll get this sort of I think, therefore I am?
I tend to doubt very much that it will be possible to create computer type of technology that will equal or exceed the activity and competence of the human mind. I'm very interested in Ray Kurzweil's futuristic suggestion that will be possible, but I think that the operation of the human mind is so elusive that it will be impossible for people to really create counterparts of it. I think artificial intelligence in that respect is an interesting activity, but I don't think it's really practical. I particularly would fear the existence of an artificial mind with the competence of the natural mind. It would be extremely dangerous for lacking the social controls that are inherent in the mind, which I exercise not only negatively but positively.
Right, this leads to my next question then. In the context of the mind, what is free will and creativity?
Well, that's a unique feature of the mind, the ability of this entity within our skull to combine items of knowledge, to innovate new knowledge, and to actually override some of the influences that automatically arise in the mind from its internal programming or instructions that are comparable to program in computers. That's the unique factor that evolution somehow through natural selection created. It's the most amazing phenomenon one can imagine. And there it is, and we're fortunate to have it, and we should take advantage of it and avoid it. It's a negative aspect.
Roy, how would you explain Shannon's statement that information is signals that are not noise?
When I started to think about the mind and drew on the model of the computer, I recognize that the mind, like a computer, operates on signals, and that information is signals. And I was thrilled to discover Shannon's statement that information is signals that are not noise. But it's a very cryptic statement that I think few people really understand. What it really means is that signals that arrive that ordinarily would be representing knowledge and facts and ideas arrive at a mind or a computer and seek entry into that machine. But they will only be received if the mind or computer is instructed or programmed to accept them and work with them. And so signals that purport to be information that are not acceptable are technically, in Shannon's idea, noise. And that different concept of noise differs so radically and confusingly from concepts of that people have that noise can constitute information. It just doesn't happen. And so that is my interpretation of Shannon's very insightful but highly technical statement.
Maybe if we take this on a sort of a parallel kind of path in terms of thinking or analysis, and you know, we're talking about noise and that sort of information that is not being accepted as input within the mind or perhaps in a computer. So would you say then that a biases will then create or I should say tag some information as noise?
I don't quite get the question.
So what happens is the human being is bombarded with lots of information coming from various sources from their senses.
Yeah.
They're absorbing this information, but their biases will then eliminate much of that information and in essence will become noise because they won't actually allow that information to be input or to be accepted further for further analysis. Let me tackle that.
The mind, in order to utilize the instinct to survive, automatically is open to possible receipt of signals. And even when people are asleep, they are relatively sensitive to signals that might represent danger. A mother, for example, and during sleep, ordinarily sensitive to children's cries at night. But in the case of computers, therefore people cannot exclude signals that are not acceptable. They're susceptible to them, but they reject them. In contrast, computers are so programmed that signals they cannot process, they don't even receive. But when people receive signals, then automatically and their biases, their ideologies and the like operate on them and characterize how they're treated within each mind individually.
Roy, what are your views on machine learning research and its relationship to your mind model?
Well, I think that the machine learning methods are ways to introduce signals of knowledge into minds in the hope that the recipients will benefit from them. Those signals are equivalent to signals introduced by people in natural interaction as teachers and otherwise.
This kind of marries then this whole idea of your legal background with your writings about the mind. So what are the legal implications in terms of all your thinking and all of the innovation that you're doing now about the mind?
Oh, that's the most interesting aspect of my work by my being a lawyer. I think that my perception, functional perception of the mind, provides an ideal way to understand how minds operate, especially how they operate on information as it is physical batches of energy signals that represent facts and ideas. And I think that it's important for people in the law to recognize this functional operation of mind in order to write laws that are factually accurate and properly carry out the social policies behind them. For example, a very simple one, information is signal, and people receive it physically, and it literally shapes their mind. I think that insight reveals that the legal rule that people cannot sue for damages for harmful input signals unless they are suffering what lawyers would regard as harm to the physical structure of the body. We should recognize that the very receipt of those signals of insult or similar forms are harmful and should be punishable by law.
Right, because the continual receipt of these signals shape the mind, sculpt the mind. And
you've got it. You absolutely are right. They shape the mind just as a sculptor would be shaping solid material.
So
it's important to people to recognize that the shape of the mind influences emotion and behavior. That is the operation of the mind in the thinking process, which occurs not only consciously but subconsciously.
What should then be the legal implications of your writings about mind information?
I think that legal people should start to recognize the physical functioning of the mind in various contexts and apply it to their laws.
Why is your current work more significant than introducing computing law in 1960?
That was fairly mundane, believe me. Computer law merely undertook to cause lawyers to think of the legal implications of the use of computers to support mind or to replace minds in various operations in automated factories and the like. And it was so basic that it just pales into insignificance. It's completely mundane now. It has been for a number of years. But thinking of the mind is so much more significant in addressing the legal aspects of behavior and conduct, and they're fundamental concepts there should be accounted for in the law.
I always consider you to be sort of this multi-domain, very innovative thinker that crosses many boundaries, and this next question sort of illustrates that, and that is, how does your work apply to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders and Sources of Mental Disturbance?
It's very interesting. My wife was a professor of clinical social work, and that made me, during most of my career, sensitive to these clinical matters. I think that my perception of the mind, if it's as accurate as I think, should be taken into account in describing, recognizing, and describing so-called mental disorders. They would be ordinarily emotional in my mind because, although I should correct myself, the abnormal minds, mental illness as against emotional disturbance should be described. But my perception, I think, is primarily helpful in providing a more accurate factual perception of what's happening in the minds of people who look for help.
How is your work on the mind in information, transformational and other fields and domains of science?
I'm presently trying to get back to writing my book about the mind. I've been diverted by extraneous activity. And in starting to write that, I made a list of the various professions to which my perception is relevant. And I'm astonished by the great variety of them. It certainly is pertinent to psychology, I think my perception provides, for example, a scientific or functional scientific type basis for a constructivist psychology, which focuses on subjectivity. I learned about that field by myself. Which was very significant, was I had never studied psychology when I went to Yale College. But it's also pertinent in most fields, law, in economics, political science. In political science, for example, this aspect of polarization becomes so relevant and helps to explain many of them. So I find that there are almost unlimited other fields of profession to which my perception is pertinent and should be embraced.
And I guess I could see the applications in the stock market.
Yes, everything, economics and everything is relevant to this perception of the mind, because the mind makes people who they are and societies what they are. And factor of greed, for example, the ideologies, things like that, they're all so, it's so pertinent to understand how they operate and influence.
You know, I've seen some reports on functional magnetic resonance imaging and showing some promise of maybe getting some pictures of what's happening in the mind and perhaps providing some early indications of mind reading. What are your views on that, of mind reading?
It seems to me, and again, I can't be the claim to be the great scientist on neuroscience, but so far I get the impression that magnetic resonance imaging primarily reveals where things happen in the mind, but not how they happen. And I think the big challenge is to discover how the mind actually manipulates batches of electrochemical signals that represent facts and ideas. I think that is what we have to learn. And I had a friend years ago, a wonderful inventor, who was trying to capture the activity of the electrochemical pulse manipulation in the mind. And he created a chicken wire sort of enclosure in which a person would sit, and he would try to capture the natural magnetic output of their mind, which occurs all the time, as it does from all conductors of electricity. Unfortunately, he was killed in an airplane accident before he could achieve that, but I gather that efforts are being made, and I think that is the way we might discover the operating manual of the mind that evolution couldn't produce directly, and understand really what's happening inside, how, and not only where.
Roy, earlier in the interview you touched on the work of Ray Kurzweil, and I guess this whole idea of a singularity where, you know, you'll be able to download your consciousness in essence, or what sort of is the essence of the mind into a computer. So I know that you have some sort of opposition to that kind of thinking. So why won't computers ever replicate the mind?
I'm not a seer, but I believe that the evolution created actual detailed operation of the mind will always remain too elusive for people to replicate it or try to exceed it. But that's my personal feeling, and that's all I can say about it. I think Ray Kurzweil, as brilliant as he is, tends to be too flamboyant and over-optimistic. And as I said, if that could be achieved, I would fear for it, because I think it's essential to have human control over activities that represent behavior. And I think back to the creation of the golem by the chief rabbi of Prague to help counteract the mistreatment of the Jews, and it required a person to guide that golem, and I think that is a fundamental factor we have to recognize.
In your travels, have you ever met Ray?
No. I had an illness not long ago, and in the hospital, a friend gave me his book, The Singularity Is Near, and I found it very difficult to accept his ideas. In my mind, the singularity is here in the human mind, and I think that is the ultimate that we can ever expect.
I know this is going to be difficult, but then how will computers augment our minds in 20 years' time?
Well, they're doing so much of it now. They're creating knowledge that's useful to the mind. They're helpful in making computations and searching and things like that. And it's so difficult to forecast what's going to happen, and I'm not able to make a great contribution in that respect. All I can say is that the way the trajectory is now in technological development, we undoubtedly will experience more helping aid for computation, for communication, and the creative minds will make that contribution. But where it'll end up, I can't say. I certainly won't be around in 20 years to witness that.
Roy, you have this amazing record, an amazing history, and you've never been one to be shy of contributing controversy or areas of discussion and so on. You've always sort of confronted it head on. So beyond what we have discussed, what would you consider some areas of controversy or much discussion in the areas that you work in or where you have interest?
My problem of controversy is this. I can't really encounter so far people with whom I can discuss this and identify the controversies. It's been very frustrating. I've been forced to be essentially a lone wolf, and that occurred even way back when I was active in computer law. I could see intellectual aspects to it that very few people could see. They were more blunt and technical. That was involved lawyers, but now I'm so frustrated by the inability to engage neuroscientists, psychologists, and others in an analysis of my perception. I was able, in only one case, by good fortune, to encounter a person with whom I could discuss my perception of the mind, and that is the former chair of the psychology department at Curry College, which is just up the road from where I live. It's a very ordinary college. But I discovered when I intruded on Jack Kahn, its former chair of psychology, to find a man who was receptive to my explaining my ideas and who confirmed, in general, their validity. But otherwise, it's sort of a cold world to try to be a missionary, but not attracting enthusiastic followers.
I guess such is the work of a pioneer, and you have this history of continuing pioneering innovation.
It certainly is, and it's so frustrating because I'm so enthusiastic about my ideas. It's frustrating to find that I have to keep searching for possible adherence.
So what innovations in your areas of expertise should we be watching for in the next 5 years?
In the area of law, I think that the adoption or recognition or acceptance of my perception of the physical function of the mind should be an invaluable contribution. I think it should be invaluable to people who have legal issues to have them resolved with a better understanding of the factual aspect instead of speculation. I think that adopting them would create a increased role for forensic psychologists to testify in court regarding mental problems and behavior and things like that in resolving issues of responsibility. I'm sort of at a loss to come up with more than that.
I'm just kind of speculating here then. Would you consider, you know, in today's world we think of some person as being evil. Would you say that then that behavioral conditioning that's occurred throughout their lives that have shaped them and sculpted them to be what we would consider to be evil?
Well, we have two aspects to that. One is psychopaths seem to be fundamentally evil, and they're not the normal people whose minds I am thinking about. But when it comes to so-called normal people, recognition of my perception, I think, will make a great contribution to understanding what influences have caused their behavior and should indicate the importance of, for example, among prisoners, of constructively integrating them back into society rather than just focusing on punishing them.
Related to your current work, do you see any specific challenges and opportunities for people who work in the computing field or businesses that they can embrace today in the next 5 years?
I certainly do. I think that a better understanding of the way the mind works, that people can deal with each other in designing activities, program more constructively and possibly overcome the polarization. That's a basic facet of my thinking.
Roy, you've been around for such a long time, and you
yeah, amazing.
Always contributing, always being a pioneer. So do you have any interesting stories to share from all of the different roles that you played, all the travels and so on?
When I was thinking about that, the potential question, I couldn't find incident amusing or amazing, but I'm sort of focused on the behavior, the diverse way presumably intelligent people behave, and it sort of enhances my curiosity. For example, a number of years ago at a meeting of the local Yale Law School Association, I encountered two fellow graduates much younger than I, and I told them about my interest then in computer law, and they went back to the dean of Boston University Law School where they were teaching, Paul Siskin, who was originally a banker, and they told him of my interest and abilities, and he promptly invited me to be an adjunct lecturer there and to teach a seminar on computer law. And that was such a positive experience. In contrast, I was frustrated by my difficulty in getting acceptance of my ideas on computer law at Yale Law School, my alma mater. And after many years of frustration, I approached then-Dean Guido Calabresi, a highly recognized professor who was interested in economics and the law. And he invited me to have tea with him at the Yale Faculty Club. And at that, I explained in detail my computer law interest, and he seemed to be positively interested in it. All I wanted from him was the opportunity to give a lecture there to the students, which I had been trying to do for many decades. And after that, not hearing from him, I wrote a follow-up, and he wrote back and said, at 70 years of age, you're not eligible to become a professor, which was completely irrelevant. Then, for example, I read that a Chinese professor, a neuroscientist at MIT, was particularly interested in synapses, which are the gap circuitry in the human mind. And I was fortunate to have the opportunity to meet him because I had the idea that synapses might be equivalent in some fashion to the switches computers themselves, switching batches of input signals among the segment circuitry that had particular significance. And I was thinking in regard to how creativity occurs in a mind, all I could think of was that creativity resulted from chaotic or random operation, which is sort of silly. And he immediately indicated that synapses operate by modulation, which is the differences in force caused by the instructions within the mind to cause batches of signals to jump over the synapse batches or to prevent that and did that by modulation. And that was very exciting. But when I was eager to try to tell the source of that insight, I asked that professor, and he said, I may not indicate it was he because I'm not a scientist. So I encountered these diverse behaviors that seem to be irrational, and that has fascinated me, but that's particularly relevant to my basic interest.
I guess you're always encountering biases about people's ideas and the sort of thinking that you have to be an expert registered scientist in a particular field to make any contribution.
But then they're not good sources because there's such a subjectivity among all people, and particularly academicians. They're so focused on their particular fields of knowledge that they're not receptive to possible new inputs. I think my strength has been my open mind and curiosity of so many things, and I think that's what's so essential.
Yeah, the multidisciplinary approach can solve many challenges and cross many boundaries and barriers.
That's what we need. That's the basic goal to achieve that, to complete interaction, open interaction, to lead to bigger and better ideas.
And to mine the pioneering efforts of innovators like yourself who have such a long history of contribution in so many different domains. So you're going to have a perspective that no one else has.
I don't know, but I find it enjoyable in my perception of what I'm doing.
Now, we've talked about many different areas in this interview, and I turn the tables in this very last question, and that is, if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answer?
I would like to learn how to, well, first I would like to recognize the functional existence of polarization and to get ideas on how to minimize, if not reduce, this normal polarization that leads to normal subjectivity that leads to polarization. I think in terms of the political science, the operation of society, that is a fundamental problem, and I think that deserves really intensive research. In fact, I don't have three questions. I'm so focused on that subjectivity, which I think is the fundamental limiting factor in the operation of the mind and the operation of society, that it's worthy of intensive study to try to identify ways to avoid it and overcome it.
Roy, I guess in your 10th decade of living and many, many decades of contribution and many, many different kinds of fields, and now, as you are doing some of your best work. So, you know, we're really fortunate you came in to do this interview, and thank you for sharing your many experiences.
Well, I must say, I so appreciate your thoughtfulness in inviting me to this interview, and I hope that it can make a real contribution widely in society. I thank you warmly and with deep appreciation.
Well, thank you, Roy, again, for doing this interview and sharing your experiences with our audience. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Roy Fried, global pioneer of computer law on computers, the mind, and information, and their serious implications.